Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to On Trial, starring Mark Radulich, also starring John Comer. You're ready, Hollywood, because you're on trial.
All rise. The Honorable Judge Fudge presiding. This is On Trial here on the one and only Radulich and Broadcasting Network. Tonight, I am your prosecuting attorney, Mr. Mark Radulich, the mandated reporter, and frankly, I'm mortified. Also, your old pal Wheezy and lap dance enthusiast. Ahem. we are racing, vroom, vroom, bang, bang, towards the end of Here in My Car Week on the Radulich and Broadcasting Network. We've brought you such fine shows as Source Material, Wacky Race Land, Damn You, Hollywood. Hollywood, if you could, The Fate of the Furious, Metal Hammer of Doom, Zombie Motors Wrecking Yard, Supersonic Rock and Roll, and our Thursday Night Delight, On Trial, where it's 420, y'all. Smoke a bowl. Light them if you got them. Smoke them if you got them. Smoke them if you got them. That's the appropriate phrase. You got to get high, because it's 420, baby. So in honor of cars and pot, tonight we put the seminal classic, Dude, Where's My Car, on trial. Defending this nonsense, my co-host, the imitable, Mr. Sean Comer. How do you do, sir?
Smoky McPot for the defense, your shibbiness.
Shibby. All right, sir. What do you got for me on notes tonight? Where's my car? What's this rich history that you've got to share for us?
Well, Cancer Slayer, this really came a Much like Ashton Kutcher's popularity in general, there really isn't some grand, spectacular, really moving onus to this movie being made. Much like Ashton Kutcher's popularity, it just kind of happened for no reason. There is no explaining it. There's no justifying it. There's no real extolling its merit. It's just kind of there, and we have to live with it. It's not a bad movie, but to give you some idea, and I kid you not, the notes that I have for this is not me being snarky and just making something up off the top of my head to poke fun at it. This is actually what I was able to dig up. The entire title, yes, you are correct in assuming that it is indeed a direct lift from the bowling alley scene between John Goodman and Jeff Bridges in The Big Lebowski. It's taken directly from that dialogue. It's actually, again, kid you not, it's a rework of a rejected live-action Beavis and Butthead movie premise that got scrapped in the late 90s. I know, it's so hard to believe, right? Jason Reitman had to turn down the studio's directing offers twice before they apparently got the message. Just think about that. How bad does your movie have to sound when you say no the first time, they come back and ask again, and you have to ask them, what part of no did you not understand? further kind of driving home the point of just what kind of movie this is. Ashton Kutcher nearly turned the role down, which would have actually opened up a spot for Seth Rogen, who also auditioned for one of the two starring roles, because Kelso himself thought the script was too stupid. Of course, then he read the You Got a Tattoo scene, couldn't stop laughing, and agreed to take on the part. No, again, that's not me tacking on a punchline. That's what IMDb told me. That was the part that sold him on it, was he couldn't stop chuckling at the You Got a Tattoo scene. The whole bit, what's mine say? Dude, what's mine say? Sweet, what's mine say? Dude, what's mine say? Sweet. Yeah, yeah, that was what sold the future Mr. Demi Moore on this movie. There's a bunch of other trivia that relates to specific parts, but the only specific scenes in the movie, but really about the only thing, the only one worth mentioning, is the fact that this played well enough with audiences, albeit not critics, to at one point warrant early development on a sequel titled Seriously, Dude, Where's My Car? But it didn't get very far, and eventually it was just kind of, probably mercifully for everybody, just kind of shunted aside altogether. I'm not reading off notes or anything, but just from what I remember personally, this came out long about my senior year of high school. In fact, I believe it preceded, of all movies, Jane, Silent Bob Strike Back by, I believe, less than a year, if I recall correctly. And this was during, again, it was kind of an inexplicable period when somehow Sean William Scott and Ashton Kutcher, of all people, became two of the most popular actors in Hollywood. I guess I have to chalk it up to the fact that the first American Pie movie did just utter gangbusters, and justifiably so, because that was the right pieces all coming together at the right time with the right script, the perfect ensemble cast. And it was hilarious. It kind of revived the teen sex comedy there for a few years, to the tune of a bunch of really inferior kind of imitators and successors and not very good sequels. Meanwhile, that 70s show for a bit was kind of the same deal. It was a fairly well-written sitcom that really, if you go back and look at it, if you really go back and take a long, hard look at the cast and who the big stars of it were, about the most talented two people of the whole thing were arguably Laura Prepon and Mila Kunis, and everybody else was just kind of marginally talented, but they did sort of, they had just enough chemistry together to kind of cancel out the fact that nobody really stood out exceptionally. And so that, combined with Punk'd and Ashton launching the whole unfortunate trucker hat thing, that was a thing for a while. As I just kind of all gave way to making this perfect little dumbass stoner comedy. That I'm not gonna talk down too much about it. I rather liked it. It has its reasons to exist, but the important thing is it's your quintessential cult movie. It was made on a $13 million budget. It's only 82 minutes long. But somehow this thing did $73.2 million at the box office. And it developed a massive audience following. the audience has absolutely adored this thing, but critics just savaged it. And it's one of those examples of where when you're really reading reviews of a movie, you have to very carefully take into account the kind of movie that you're reading reviews for and who the reviews are written by. Because to really sum it up, you almost have to read these reviews and these little snippets in an imitated voice of the most obnoxious hipster douche you've ever laid eyes upon in your life, to really kind of get a sense for them. For example, this snippet comes from no less than Rotten Tomatoes, and it declares, "The movie isn't funny, the plot is too thin, and the production values feel more like a TV sitcom than a movie." Metacritic, where it received a score of 30 out of 100 based on 17 critics, gave it generally unfavorable reviews. No meat shit. What else we have here? The BBC film review. So you can almost go one of two ways. You can almost go with your typical Village Voice hipster critic, or you could choose to go almost kind of like a William Regal route. If you want to declare it a lame-brained travesty and intensely irritating. and calling Sean William Scott and Ashton Kutcher's antics painfully unamusing. USA Today, this was a gem. Any civilization that can produce a movie this stupid probably deserves to be hit by famine and pestilence. The Chicago Tribune, and I swear to God, this sounds like one of those painfully unfunny quips that the Gene Shalit would have made. And I can just kind of, because it is civilization. I'm mixing my quotes up here. At the end of 83 unmerciful minutes, audiences will be exclaiming, "Dude, I can't believe I sat through that movie." Yeah, you see, you hear that, and you can almost imagine that. You can almost imagine that goofy looking afroed idiot kind of staring into a camera and just kind of going, "Am I right?" And last but not least, we have the New York Post calling it an almost chuckle-free mess, so amateurish and lame that the cast often has that embarrassed look you see on dogs given ridiculous haircuts. You know, the more I say it, the more I start to think that I'm just sounding like the goth kids on South Park.
You definitely are very close to at least the one kid. Like I'm definitely picturing you waving your hair.
Well, my hair is actually long enough that if I wanted to, I could get away with it. But really, think about it. And if you're listening to this, I have to assume that you've probably seen the movie and you're just curious to hear what we have to say about it. But is this the kind of movie where you really trust critics? I mean, these are the people who go out of their way to, since this is here in my car week, who go out of their way to absolutely savage stuff like the Fast and the Furious movies and come across like they were whatever sequel it was they happened to be watching, like they thought that it was going to be directed by Martin Scorsese. and they had all of a sudden swapped out Vin Diesel in favor of Daniel Day-Lewis and substituted Eddie Redmayne for Dwayne Johnson. and like they were expecting some kind of treatise on the human spirit and the duality of man's nature and what tempts one to good or evil. No, it's cargo fast bingo boom. That's what it is. The name of the movie is Dude, Where's My Car? It stars the tall, long-haired doofus from that 70s show and the blonde bro dude doofus from American Pie. Critics, talk me through exactly what you were expecting here. Were you anticipating, again, like Pacino and De Niro? Were you expecting the kind of magic of Leonardo DiCaprio and Tom Hanks? No, it was a Kmart Cheech and Chong. It wasn't even that, because, let's face it, I think even Kevin Smith would agree, Jay and Silent Bob are the Kmart Cheech and Chong. So I guess that would make Sean William Scott and Ashton Kutcher, Jesse and Chester, the found next to the sunglasses rack at 7-Eleven, Jay and Silent Bob. Is that kind of how cheap we're going here? Just don't watch it sober. Best advice I can give you, it's fun, but check your brain out at the door. Watch it after a couple of beers, and you'll get through it just fine. I always do. I'm always willing to put it on if I need just something to just kill a few brain waves for a little bit. But yeah, we can get into my defense of it in just a little while. But first, I want to throw it over to you, Your Excellency, so that you can run down the, as it were, the plot.
Yeah, there's a plot here, I suppose. All right. Without belaboring the point as such, we begin our movie with our titular characters, Jesse and Chester. They are awakened with hangovers, with no memory of the previous night. They're watching Animal Planet. They get hungry. They find a lifetime supply of pudding in their fridge. And then there's an answering machine that contains an angry message from their twin girlfriends. Poor Jennifer Garner. Poor Jennifer Garner. Their names are Wilma and Wanda. And they basically, you know, you forgot our anniversaries, you guys stink, et cetera, et cetera. What they reveal is that they have, in fact, anniversary gifts for their twin girlfriends. It's in the car. They get dressed. They go outside. As it turns out, they don't know where the car is. And the question is asked, dude, where's my car? This goes on for an hour and a half. When they're finally done asking, dude, where's my car? Basically, the rest of this movie is Memento for dummies. It's a mystery told in reverse, as they discover clues as to what happened the night before. There is a tattoo scene, as mentioned earlier, but they're not tattooing clues all over themselves. But basically, little by little, they are discovering things that have happened. A run-in with a transgendered person where they were supposed to steal some money. This money is, in fact, stolen. But they go and they go on a spending spree, which leads to more clues, which leads to more shenanigans. Overall, what this is about is there's an alien group of people. They are hot chicks. They want the continuum transfunctioner. And then there are some Swedish fellas, both aliens. IKEA is from Sweden. I like meatballs. They are also after the continuum transfunctioner, And there's a group of nerds who want to go to space. They, too, are after the Continuum Transfunctioner. And that is the big thing you want to draw the circle around as far as what this movie is about. This all leads to, after several misadventures and kidnapping scenes, this leads to a scene at the very end of the movie where they are at like a Dave and Buster's type place or Chuck E. Cheese. All of the various characters meet at this one area. There is the decision whether or not they should give the transfunctioner to the hot chicks, or the hot chicks the good guys, or to the Swedish fellas. They eventually figure out that the Rubik's Cube that they've had on them is in fact the Continuum Transfunctioner, which they give to the Swedish fellas. This causes the hot chicks to form Devastator, Attack of the 50-Foot Woman. And she goes on a rampage. They use the Continuum Transfunctioner, going all the way back to the first gag of the movie. Because you see, they were watching an ape, a chimpanzee, use tools and twigs to get food. And so they use a straw to push a button. The button makes the transfunctioner do a thing. The thing destroys the hot chick that turned into Devastator. It was Attack of the 50-Foot Woman. They save the day. They prove themselves worthy. They destroy the ring. They throw the Emperor down the shaft, and they blow up the Death Star and go home. Since they saved the day and they gave the transfunctioner back to the Swedish guys, Ikea is from Sweden. I like meatballs. They are given presents. Presents are given to the girlfriends. The girlfriend's boobs become bigger. Poor Jennifer Garner. You have to ask yourself this question. Was this a worse choice for her than Elektra? That is pretty much where we leave the movie. Another day passes. Their memories are erased of all of these incidents. And, of course, we get the dude wears my car bit one more time. But as it turns out, it's just hiding behind a mail truck. And that, of course, is the movie. Now, look. Sean went through all the trouble of reading these quote-unquote reviews. And there's a reason why on Damn You Hollywood, Robert Winfrey and I viciously attack the critics because they do their job poorly and we feel the need to point that out. You must judge a movie in the context of its intent. If the movie itself is intended to be a modern-day B-movie riff on the old late-at-night sci-fi type nudie cutie type nonsense movies that were made on a shoestring budget with a bunch of nobody actors done for a laugh. If you're trying to do a movie that emulates the old drive-in B movie, then that is how you should judge the thing. This isn't Apocalypse Now. This is Nude on the Moon. Okay. Amazon.
Remind me, which one is defending and which one is prosecuting this movie again?
Hang on, I'm getting there. So, as Sean is indicating, it sounds like I'm defending this movie. What I am simply saying is, as I go ahead and prosecute this movie, you will know from me that I am judging it on its merits by its intent. I am not judging it against The Godfather. I'm not even judging it against the modern comedy. I am judging it against its intended genre, the nudie cutie, the late night drive-in, the up after dark movie on UPN Channel 9. And with the bar that low, I will now attempt to show you.
Hey, Son, you pump your brakes before you take shots at USA up all night, boy.
Fair enough, fair enough.
That's my adolescence you're messing with.
With all that said, I will construct at least a single argument, and I do mean singular, against this movie. Because as a nudie cutie, as an up all night, as a drive-in movie, there are some failures of craft, failures that need addressing. So if it pleases the court, the Honorable Judge Fudge, I have two major criticisms of this movie, most of which cast. Because there's nothing wrong with the craft of it. It's actually a solid film in terms of setting up and building on and then finally resolving a mystery. It's actually, if you allow yourself to laugh at such things, pretty funny. I'm a sucker for a running gag, and there's lots of them in this thing. There's the aforementioned dude sweet tattoo scene, which to me was funny. Obviously, it was also the Ashton Kutcher. We are hot chicks. Every time it was said, I laughed. Even Andy, Dick, and Data in their exchanges are, if you allow yourself to relax and have a good time with it, pretty Brett Spiner, pretty funny. Here's the problem. And I'm going to start with the bigger problem first. If this thing runs at approximately 82 minutes, we don't even get a full 90 minutes of film here, but at 82 minutes, you spend the entire length of that 82 minutes with Jesse and Chester. Now, you can do that. Certainly, there are plenty of movies that do. They never cut away from their star. You're with them the entire time. And in many cases, this is a schema that works. This is a craft element that works. It doesn't in this movie because Jesse and Chester are A, not that interesting, B, not that funny, and C, not that charismatic. 82 minutes is a long time to spend with either of the actual actors, let alone these fucking characters. Okay? There needed to be, and I guess it would be difficult to do when you're telling it from the first person perspective and your whole structure is mystery. Is amnesia mystery. So I understand where this might have actually taken some time to figure out how they were going to do it, but there needed to be cutaways. You needed to at least cut away to the hot chicks, cut away to the Swedish guys, cut away to the girlfriends, as much as they weren't characters either. Poor Jennifer Garner. Or if you're going to spend 82 minutes with these idiots, make them more charismatic. Make them more interesting. Make them funnier. Make the gags funnier. The problem is that this whole movie, after a while, is supported by the rest of the cast holding up their ends of the jokes, because Ashton Kutcher, and then this brings me to my second point, especially Sean William Scott, are not enough to carry this film. Not for 82 minutes without a break. Now, as I say, they're not funny enough, they're not charismatic enough. Ashton Kutcher is fucking Barack Obama in terms of charisma. He's Hulk fucking Hogan compared to Sean William Scott. Ashton Kutcher's Jesse Montgomery III. Really? Montgomery III, eh? All right. At least has a character, shows a degree of leadership quality, is generally pushing the action forward. I could have almost tolerated him for the duration of the movie, except that he's standing next to negative charisma, a black hole of charisma, somebody who actually detracted from the film. He's so bad in this. And I don't mean so bad he's good. I don't mean bad compared to Al Pacino in Scarface. I mean, he's not good even in a role as a stoner. Which, if Sean William Scott can't play a stoner, then something has gone functionally wrong with your screenplay. Was the director high during this thing? Because I feel like he got no direction in this. And he's just generally unlikable. That's why he worked well as Stifler in the American Pie movies. He's the villain. He's the bad guy. You're not supposed to like him. And so when someone bangs his mom, you're like, yay, the jerk got his. He got into the Muppets. And he brings that same level of ickiness to this character. And it's not like he's playing a character who's supposed to be icky. You're supposed to cheer for him. You're supposed to be with him and Ashton Kutcher through the 82 minutes of this feature. And I had no compelling reason to see him succeed. I was fine with Ashton Kutcher succeeding. I didn't want to see him get beat up by a tranny. I didn't want to see him get killed by a 50-foot woman. I was upset. And I was rooting for him when he was trapped in a cage by Brent Spiner. But in any one of those circumstances, had anything bad happened to Sean William Scott, I would not have given a hoot. That is a function of craft that strikes at the heart of this movie and causes it to be not as good as it might have been for the kind of movie it was trying to be. Beyond that, like I said, they didn't bother to flesh out any of the other characters. There really are no other characters in this movie. And a movie with no characters is primarily flawed. It just is. You don't write a movie and not have characters in them. Even a nudie cutie, a drive-in movie, an Up After Dark has characters. They may not be completely fleshed out, but they've got them in there. You could have replaced Jennifer Garner and the other broad who plays her twin sister, with cardboard cutouts and gotten the same level of performance out of them. The rest of the cast is fine. You know, they're gags. They're walking gags, but they're fine. They're fine as gags. They're acceptable. Everything else about the movie is fine. It's exactly what it's supposed to be. Your witness, sir.
Thank you, Zoltan. What can I say about Dude, Where's My Car? Well, I'll tell you something. I definitely have something to say about Dude, Where's My Car? And it's this. Cannabis clone, mirror automobile, pudding, bubble wrap, marijuana mini skirt, miniature person, chief pizza tattoo, old woman hit by car, dog, nipples visible through clothing, urination, buddy, nerd, alien, teenager, giant, ostrich, Chinese restaurant, amnesia, strip club, police, idiot friendship, breast growing, homoeroticism, homosexual subtext, giant woman, lesbian kiss, bare-chested male, transsexual, gay kiss. Those are just a few of the 60 plot keywords listed on IMDb for Dude, Where's My Car? Incidentally, I refuse to believe that isn't just a perfectly fine summing up of the plot in general, but I digress. The fact is, occasionally, every so often, and I know that this is a revelation in a sequel-happy, franchise-obsessed world of movies, but occasionally you make a comedy with just the right people at just the right time, And you almost have to express amazement that it got made at all. But when it's a hit, you leave well enough alone and just say, yeah, yeah, world, I did that. These two chuckleheads may not be able to act their way out of a paper bag otherwise, and God forbid this Nimrod with the flippy hair should ever get a plum role in a biopic about one of his generation's greatest technological and entrepreneurial pioneers, because, well, God help us all if Hollywood ever sinks that low. But the fact is, sometimes it works that way. You know, sometimes, instead of making a Hangover trilogy where you take the same movie and make it three times in slightly different locales with a very slightly varied premise, but recycling pretty much all of the exact same gags, you instead make Superbad. You make a movie that isn't necessarily especially smart, but you get the right people in the movie at the right time, when they're actually accessible, when you can afford them, when they're actually willing to consider your dumb little movie. Occasionally, as Superbad did, just, you know, turning to people you happen to be pals with anyway. And, you know, maybe you don't get an inimitable duo that has chemistry for movie after movie to come, like, well, Jay and Silent Bob, or Cheech and Chong, Laurel and Hardy, Abbott and Costello, so on and so forth. Sometimes, you know, you get Jonah Hill and Michael Cera. Sometimes you get two people who play exactly one character each really, really well. But sometimes you put those two right characters in just the right movie, and you maybe throw in a couple of other people who would become surprising breakout stars later, like, say, oh, I don't know, and Emma Stone, as the case might be. Pepper in a couple decent cameos here and there, as the case would be in Superbad. You throw in Bill Hader and Seth Rogen, among a couple others. And what do you know? You actually get a one-off lightning-in-a-bottle favorite that people can keep coming back to. Sometimes you just have to celebrate that for what it is. And you know, my counterpart on the prosecution is absolutely right. When it comes to Ashton Kutcher and Sean William Scott, folks, we are not talking about Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd here. We are not referring to one of the quintessential comedy duos in cinematic history. No, keep in mind, we are in fact talking about Kelso and Stifler, and we are indeed talking about the only two kinds of characters these two have ever really historically played well. No, sit down and shut up. I am not giving Ashton Kutcher credit for Jobs. I mean, again, we're talking about two guys who at the time had an immense Q rating, who were hugely popular. They looked to possibly have it potential in the eyes of someone who has sway over these things. This was at a time when these two were about to be absolutely every fucking where. And someone had the presence of mind to bring them together as one at kind of just the right time. It's much like Seth Rogen and James Franco. You know, sometimes two people have got it and get them together on just the right project. And magic just happens. It just kind of comes together. It doesn't mean you can repeat it, but you can at least enjoy it just that once. And that's why it's a good thing that this is kind of structured the way it does, and why it does actually have a little bit of a supporting cast to play off of. And no, I mean, when I talk about supporting cast, we're not talking about the likes of Steve Buscemi and Philip Seymour Hoffman and Clint Howard and Wallace Shawn and other great character actors who are popping up out of nowhere. No. Nothing that impressive. We're just talking about a bunch of people who read this script, knew it wasn't exactly going to be Hamlet, and they just decided the hell with it. We're just going to have fun with it anyway. You know, Rowdy Roddy Piper made an entire movie career out of doing just that. You feel me? I mean, you think every movie he ever made was hell? He ever made was They Live or Hell Comes to Frogtown? No. Every so often, the man read something that was just absolutely atrocious. He knew it, but he went out there and decided, screw it. I got to be here. I'm getting paid. I'm at least going to amuse myself. That's what you have here. Yeah, I agree. This was certainly not exactly going to shortlist Jennifer Garner for the Golden Globes or Academy Awards that year. Marla Sokoloff, who played Wilma, would certainly go on to bigger and better things. But really, for someone like Christy Swanson, I mean, who cared? What else was she really doing at the time? All she had to do was show off, put her twin Buffies on display, and collect a check. That was really about all anybody was asking of her. We got a nice little cameo from Hal Sparks, who's one of those fairly funny guys who just mostly seems to pop up in bit roles. But when he does, it's usually pretty enjoyable. I mean, good Lord, this is a movie that still manages to be entertaining despite the fact that we got the lesser of the O'Connells. Oh, no. They didn't even need Jerry for this one. They had to settle for Charlie, and Charlie still brought it home. That's how smoothly everything just kind of comes together. It just works. You don't want to think too hard about why, but then again, maybe that's part of the appeal too. Maybe it's just the fact that they weren't really trying too hard to be something that they weren't. I mean, after all, that's the big problem that I have with movies like, oh man, I'm trying to think of a better example than this series, but I just can't, like Sharknado or anything of that similar like. It's a movie that's trying to be bad. It's trying far too hard to be amusing. This doesn't do that. It never pretends to be something that it's not. It's not even really trying to be insidious satire necessarily. It just is what it is. It's 83 minutes of moronic adventures with Kelso and Stifler. It's so hard to hate because, as you mentioned, of the two of them, yeah, Ashton, God help me, is actually the charisma of these two. You know, the Demi Moore's future kept doofus Iowa frat boy is actually the winning personality of the pair. It hurts my head even now to say that. But when you put him together with when you put him together with Sean William Scott, Jesse and Chester are just they're too lovably insipid to ever really hate them or even really be annoyed by them. You can't even really find them irritating in any way. And every so often, yeah, they manage to come across. Really what this is, and it just now dawned on me, ladies and gentlemen of the turkey jerky. This, you're going to hate me for saying this. This is Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead or waiting for Godot on a metric ton of ganja.
Hang on, I do love the fact that we've now compared this movie. We have now, on this podcast, on the Rattlers and Broadcasting Network, have compared Dude, Where's My Car? To Memento, Guildenstern, Waiting for Godot, and the other one you said. That's incredible.
Well, and
someone needs to give us an award.
It's a loose comparison, but it's what happens when you have really no major stakes to speak of, nothing serious to say. You just have random interactions between these two hapless boobs and a bunch of other random crazy-ass people that they sort of collide with. That, to me, is what this movie is. And if you want to see that really summed up, you have to watch the absolute funniest part of the movie is the scene with Jesse and Chester and an uncredited Brent Spiner and Andy Dick. The movie is worth it just for that, just to watch how much fun those four are all clearly having. Yeah, just working that scene together. It's goofy, it's insipid, it ends in an absurd, over-the-top climax. It's about everything you could ask for 82 minutes of I just don't want to think. You know, and that's especially valuable now because we live in a time wherein there's this idea that everything has to have a message. Everything has to say something powerful. It has to assume the bully pulpit and take down any and all injustice. No, it really doesn't. Folks, and I'm not just talking about the makers of fine television and video games and movies, but just general people on social media. Every other phrase you speak doesn't have to be a topical Donald Trump joke. Trust me. It'll be okay if you let the topical humor go for just a minute and just take some things for what they are. Just let yourself not be the hammer for a moment because not everything is a nail. It's slightly off topic. I read a review of an episode of NXT earlier that claimed that Bobby Roode has been working a Donald Trump gimmick since he came to the company.
Are you fucking kidding me?
Mark, you have no idea. If I were to rub my laptop right now and Robin Williams were to pop out and offer me three wishes, my first one would be that I could say I was joking about that statement. No.
That is horrible.
I'm not. Now you're a devout wrestling fan, so I'm going to assume that you watch NXT on the regular, right?
Yes, I'm also aware of the Bobby Roode character from TNA. Go on.
Yeah, I was going to say. So I'm sure you would probably agree with me that if anything, right now, he's a combination of the character he was portraying in TNA, except for his beer money days, pretty much from the time Team Canada disbanded, with just the right dash of at his peak Ric Flair throwback.
Yes, that would be an accurate description.
Yeah, but this person's rationale is, oh, well, he's come into TNA talking all big ever since last year, but now that he's – and he never expected to be champion, but now that he's champion, he actually has to try. No.
Okay. That's
what this person's rationale was. Whereas, of course, obviously, since he came into TNA, since he came to NXT, he had been prophesizing that he would be NXT champion. Hell, the night he had his glorious celebration after he won the belt, the first words he said were, "I'm normally not the kind of guy to say I told you so. Who am I kidding? I'm totally that guy. I told you so." You know, okay.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I got to get this out because Robert and I talked about this when we never reviewed the Boss Baby for a variety of reasons. But this has come up a bunch of times, and it definitely came up when we had sort of a side discussion of Boss Baby, and that was this incessant need to compare anything in a suit with money to Donald Trump. That, you know, that going as far back as 2016 with some of these movie reviews that we looked at, people saying this is a Trumpy movie, or we're living in a Trump world. It's like, no. Does anyone not remember Wall Street from the 80s? I mean, the Donald Trump as a trope isn't a new thing, nor is it Trump.
Oh, no.
Yes, Donald Trump is a rich person who wears a suit and has successfully run for office. He ain't the first, won't be the last, and we should stop comparing everything to him, for fuck's sake.
Well, it's in general, it's no different from, I'm sure you remember when The Dark Knight Rises hit theaters, and in his typical, hey, look at me, I'm Mr. Meeseeks, look at me fashion, Rush Limbaugh tried to draw the absolutely idiotic, even if he was even faintly joking, it was moronic, assertion that somehow using Bane in the movie as a villain was supposed to be some kind of roundabout and down the rabbit hole reference to Mitt Romney's ties to Bane Capital. Okay. But the point
I do remember
being,
that, and it was embarrassing when I heard it.
Yeah, wasn't it, though? But the whole point being is, folks, the reason we're describing all that is the fact that this is where you have taken us in terms of reading something into absolutely everything. Not everything has to have a message. Not everything has to necessarily serve a greater good. Sometimes you just want to be entertained. Sometimes, you know, it isn't dry British wit that you want. You know, sometimes you really just want to see Rick dance across your screen with a good old wubba-lub dub dub. Sometimes you just want the stupid. You just want that rejected Beavis and Butthead concept. That's what this is. That's all this was ever meant to be. It just happened to be a movie that came along and did this with two guys who were arguably at that point near quite possibly the peak of their careers as far as success would go. Yes, Ashton, that 70s show was pretty much it for you. But otherwise, it's why you just can't really find this movie guilty of anything except being moronic. And, well, take a look at everything we've sent to the top of the ratings and every other form of media. Since when did that become a crime? Oh, you have the floor. Go ahead. Why do I get the feeling Mark sent me a Facebook message saying...
No. I had myself on mute because I didn't want there to be... I didn't want there to be background noise, so I had to quickly take myself off mute. All right. Normally, this is the part of the show where, you know, prosecution has the last word, and then we kind of start to dribble out of the show. Folks, there is so thin a line that I don't have any last words. I said everything I needed to say already. I'm still in awe over somebody who deems himself appropriate to review a wrestling show, thinking that Bobby Roode is doing a Trump fucking gag. That I need to go wander into the woods and live deliberately for a while. Jesus, Mary and Joseph.
I gotta look up the review of this show. I forget which episode it was. I don't know if it was NXT Orlando or not. I forget. Maybe it's possible that the guy was just a really big Cassius Ohno mark, and he was just really excited to see Ohno back, and that was what the deal was. In fact, that was what it was. That was the episode it was. It was the episode when Ohno challenged Roode for the NXT championship.
I don't want to bury people, but what website is this that this person writes for?
You know, that's really the amazing thing because I could swear it was Uproxx, and their wrestling coverage actually normally isn't all that bad.
Okay, at least it wasn't like 411 or something like that. Because if it had been 411,
oh,
I might have lost.
Oh God, be real. A handful of people aside, when have you ever known me to blatantly plug anything on 411 Mania?
Fair enough.
About the only people on that site that I will willingly point people toward are among the regulars are Jeremy Thomas, Tony Acero, and Robert Winfrey. That's about it. Everywhere else, I'll
Robert
just tell
Winfrey,
people.
Fuck. Robert Winfrey, fuck that guy. No, just kidding. I love Robert Winfrey. That's my brother from another mother.
Well, yeah, because I mean, Sam Mercady and Jeremy Lambert both write elsewhere as well now. In fact, Jeremy Lambert is over on FPGnews.com these days, as is my good buddy Stuart Lang. Who else? Greg DeMarco has Yes Wrestling. I don't need to point anybody toward 411, but no, it was. If it wasn't Uproxx, it was another. I don't think it was Bleacher Report because their wrestling coverage is also ordinarily pretty solid, but it wasn't something like Sportskeeda either, which is again okay. Why I was so surprised to read that. I know people are hard on NXT, but my God, to think that about poor Bobby Roode, what did he ever do to you?
I was like, it would be more accurate to say Bobby Roode is blatantly ripping off Ted DiBiase, the Million Dollar Man, and he is. This is basically a modern retelling of that very same gimmick, which gets redone every couple of years anyway. I mean, Triple H did a version of it. Batista did a version of it. You know, I mean, everyone again eventually puts on
JBL.
A suit, acts like, yeah, JBL is one of the biggest
JBL
defenders.
Pretty much did it. Well, he pretty much did it. He was able to do it pretty much because he lived the gimmick.
Yeah. also, I mean, if anything, Bobby Roode is just, you know, is just engaging in the rich tradition of being the, you know, trope typical rich douchebag heel. A tale as old as time, ladies and gentlemen. As long as there has been wrestling, there has been a rich douchebag heel, whether they be a little on the effeminate side, like a Gorgeous George, you know, or a rich douchebag, like, you know, the Million Dollar Man. Anyway, back to Dude, Where's My Car? welcome to Wrestling Talk with Sean and Mark. I don't have a whole lot else to say. This is one of our shows where, you know, we picked an easy movie to have some fun with, and that's it. I went into this show going, what in the hell am I going to say about this thing? And, you know, when I really thought about the problems I was having with the movie, it really came down to the two leads and, you know, and whether or not they were interesting enough to carry the film. And beyond that, everything else I think is just either piling on or gross misunderstanding of the movie. So with that said, I think we are going to start to draw to a close here. This has been Here in My Car Week on the Rattlesnake Broadcasting Network. As I said, we did a whole bunch of car theme shows. We did a review of the Wacky Raceland comic book, which is yet another reimagining from the DC Hanna-Barbera line. You either like that shit or you don't, folks. We did a review of The Fate of the Furious, which, you know, if you haven't heard it yet, but you like Damn You Hollywood because you get to hear Mark and Robert yell at one another, we actually both were pretty dispassionate about this movie. I mean, Robert went into his Mr. Wizard thing for a little bit. You know, things don't work that way. But, I mean, he had said at the beginning of the review, he was like, oh, is this going to be one of those where we're going to yell at each other? I'm like, I would have to be engaged and passionate about a movie for me to be yelling at about it. And I was entertained. Here, spoiler alert. I was entertained, but much like a lap dance, once it was over, I forgot about it. You know, it was fun while it was happening. Over on the Metal Hammer of Doom, we've been missing Robert Cooper. He's been working like a dog, and we haven't been able to change up the schedule to accommodate him. So he's missed the last couple of shows. Hopefully he'll be with us next week for When in Rome Week. Another theme week here on the Rattlesnake Broadcasting Network, because boy, I like gimmicks. We reviewed the Zombie Motors Wrecking Yard, some Stoner Rock, BAS. It was a very good show. One of our tighter shows. Me and Jesse just hit it and quit it because we don't play. Lots of good Stoner Rock on there. Gave the album an average review. The boys from Australia brought it as best they could, and we're hoping for some big things from that group. Tomorrow night on the Rattlesnake Broadcasting Network, the Screaming Boy podcast ends our week-long look at the Cars here in Macaw. They're going to look at famous cars in movies. That's Ronnie Adams, He Speaks for the Trees, and the disapproving dad, Jesse Starcher, and a cast of thousands. Next week, as I said, it's When in Rome Week. We're going to start things off on Monday with not a comic book from Marvel or DC for once. We're going to look at Jonathan Hickman's Pax Romana. On Tuesday, Andrew Graham, friend of the network, will come on. We're going to discuss the Netflix docudrama series, Roman Empire, Reign of Kings, Reign of Blood, rather, all about the Commodore 64 and his wacky rule of Rome. On Wednesday, we've got Ex-Zio, The Immortal Wars, as it's all about the fall of the Roman Empire. And then Thursday, Pat Mullen's going to make me review the Lizzie McGuire movie. Why the Lizzie McGuire movie, and what does it have to do with anything? Well, it takes place in Rome, you see. And then the following week, I'm mentioning this one plug. I'm going to end my plugs here because my daughter, my lovely, lovely six-year-old daughter, Lily Rattledge, happened to have said on one of her mother's video casts where she was selling her posh wares, my podcast sucks. Okay? That's what she said. She said, don't listen to my daddy's podcast. They stink. They're terrible.
Hogwash.
And I asked her, And I asked her, I said, Lily, what? Why do you say such things when you know I will kill you for it? And I, Lex Luthor, criminal mastermind of our age. And I said, well, why would you say such things? And she said, you don't have enough women on your podcast. You don't have enough girls. My daughter, the feminist, ladies and gentlemen, the six-year-old feminist.
Okay.
So.
Well then, note to self, we need to get Alexis on some more shows.
That's funny you mentioned that. That's where I was headed with all this nonsense. In 2 weeks, just confirmed, Alexis Tana will be joining me on a TV party tonight, 2 weeks from, or a week from this Tuesday, and we will be discussing the Powerpuff Girls Season 1. Currently
available. Oh, yes. Yes, I forgot about that.
So, the sausage party will be interrupted by a woman herself, a goyle, Alexis Haina. She sells things. You should buy her things. But she's going to take a break from selling things to talk to me about the Powerpuff Girls. So now my podcast will suck less. Okay, Lily? She's sleeping. She can't hear me.
Well, and here I thought her response was going to be, because I don't like that floppy-haired dupus Sean.
No. Of course not. Never in a million years.
What are you still dragging that rotting, farting albatross around for?
All right, rotting, farting albatross, do your plugs.
You didn't have to agree with me. Hey, I'll tell you what I am going to plug, since I'm going on vacation in the fairly near future, and since I'm going to be coming back with some money in my pocket. Mark, Hey, Mark, here's a question for you. Those were some awfully handsome Fight Rattling Fight t-shirts that I saw you and your family sporting on Facebook earlier. You want to tell me what's the deal with that, buddy?
Thank you for queuing that up for me. Yes, I did want to plug that. If you go over to represent.com/fightrattleitsfight, you too can join in the fight against cancer and pick yourself up a fancy-dancy, highfalutin Fight Rattleitsfight Fight t-shirt. For $24.99, you can look good in the fight against cancer. And a portion of those proceeds will, in fact, be donated to myself and my family in the fight against my own personal fight against large diffuse B-cell lymphoma. And what money is not used directly for our needs in this fight will, at the end, once I am finally cured of this thing, be donated to a worthy cause in the fight against cancer. So that's represent.com. Fight, rattle, and fight for your fancy schmancy fight, rattle, and fight t-shirt that you can see me and my family wearing on Facebook right now.
That was the most ham-fisted segue.
That's only the best here on the Rattle Legend Broadcasting Network.
Well, also, I mean, I was going to ask anyway, because I actually badly want to order one, but I'm a little cash short right about now. I'll be ordering mine probably in the next couple of weeks after I get back from vacation, because those are pretty styling, man.
Yeah, real quick, and I'm actually going to do a separate, just a quick little video cast on YouTube, and then I'll repost it to the network, kind of advertising it. But not to get all serious here, if I can be serious for a moment, not to detract from the fun we're having. I don't take charity well, and I don't take help well. I was offered muscle relaxers today because I've been having a lot of muscle aches and pains that go along with having this particular kind of cancer. It also goes along with being exhausted from chemo, and I have been told, don't keep things to myself. Tell the nurse, tell the doctor, tell your wife, tell a wrestler, tell a friend, tell a phone when you have issues. Otherwise, I wouldn't talk about any of this. So in the spirit of all these things, I have been as transparent as I can with all of my various aches and pains and various doohas. But when the offer was made by, when I told the nurse practitioner, hey, I'm having some aches and pains, that's usually a sign that I need to slow down and take a rest. She was like, do you want muscle relaxers? And I gave her, I kind of did the, you know, I raise rock look, you know. I was like, hey, you know, I gave her this sort of quizzical look, and she was like, well, you told me you're in pain. Listen, Mac, I'm a glorified drug dealer. You tell me you're in pain, I got what you need. And I was like, look, Yosemite Sam is my spirit totem. I ain't no mamby-pamby. It's just a little pain. I can deal with it. And part of that is, growing up a wrestling fan, you also, you if you're really as deep into it as I've been, and I've actually known quite a few wrestlers in my time, muscle relaxers are not something you really want to mess with unless you really need them.
No.
And the propensity for abuse is high. And so it's not just, I'm a tough guy and I can take the pain. It's also, I don't want to put something in my body that I don't absolutely need that has a propensity for abuse.
I hear you. I'll tell you. I mean, as the years have gone on, I've actually had a couple people wonder why I haven't gone on medication for depression. And the short answer that I've given them is I have a real thing about prescription drugs. The more detailed one that I don't want to explain is that, much like you, it's my deep and long-time abiding, not only wrestling fandom, but also kind of my knowledge of it in terms of kind of the unfortunately tragic backstage history of the business, that leads me to be very, very wary of how quickly anybody can get hooked on that stuff if they're desperate enough.
I'm on enough meds as it is. So, you know, I'm on meds for my heart. I'm on, you know, prednisone, and I'm on some other stuff. And those are things I have to take in addition to the chemo. I've got enough drugs in me. I don't need more. And so if occasionally I have a muscle spasm while I'm driving or whatever, you know, or just going about my daily course of business, I give a little stretch, I give a little whistle, and I always let my conscience be my guide. And I get through it. A little pain never killed anybody. So with that said, that's just the physical stuff. I'm even worse when it comes to like help in any other schema, in any other sphere. And so the idea, and this is just rounding back to where we started with this, the idea of asking anyone for help, monetary or otherwise, outside of my own parents, I can't handle it. I can't deal with it. You know, I damn near crawled out of work once when I couldn't breathe because I refused to let anyone, you know, carry me out in a wheelchair, which was the offer. It takes a lot for me to accept help from anybody because I feel like, and it's one of the things that drives me, my wife a little crazy about me, is I feel like I'm strong enough that I can handle anything. I'll push through. I'll make it work. I'll get through it somehow. And I'll just recover the next day. So when my friend made the shirt, now originally he just made the shirt just as a gift and, hey, I'm with you, I support you. And this is my good friend John Brodigan from New York, who I used to do the Whiskey Rebellion with and PC Live and all of that. His family has had their own struggles with cancer, so this is near and dear to his heart. And he was just doing it out of the kindness of his heart, and we appreciated it. It was other people, friends of ours, who said, that's a snazzy shirt, where can I get one? And when we pitched that back to him, he was like, well, look, I'll set you up a little thing on represent.com. You take a little money for yourself. You can sell as many shirts as there's people willing to buy them. Never in a million years would I tell people, buy my shirt. I need the money. If you want a shirt, by all means, buy a shirt, and I will love you that much more for it. And I mean it when I say whatever money we get from this is going directly towards this fight, and whatever money is not needed will be donated. I don't want charity. I don't need charity. I am not a charity case. We are strong. We are Rattledge, and we are fighters. But I am certainly willing to accept people buying this shirt because they want it and using that money for a worthy cause. I hope that doesn't make me sound like too much of a jackass, but that's just where I am and who I am and what it's all about for me. So represent.com/fight Rattledge fight for a snazzy Fight Rattledge Fight t-shirt.
Well said, and I don't think that makes you sound like a jackass at all. I mean, it makes you sound very, well, forgive me, brain not good with words of smart, eloquent making lately. Tanyan Zyrtec. Admirably candid. I think is the word that I'm looking for. Again, I'm granted it's not cancer, but the worst I've been through lately is I've had to deal with, I doubled the daily dose of Zyrtec and watched Rick and Morty before going to bed, and oh God, the hallucinations were not the good kind. They were the bad, confusing, what is life kind. But
do you care if it falls? What falls? The Empire. Fuck it.
but no, I appreciate and admire and respect the hell out of how forthcoming you're being, and the fact that you're doing what you can to help raise money for those who are embroiled in the same fight that you're in. And yeah, we are all of us, everybody who loves you is rooting for you every single day, to pop up power bomb this thing until it refuses to get back up again. By all means, Sami Zayn this fucker, you know, put it down and make sure that it stays down. So, yeah, I cannot wait to proudly sport the red, black, and blue for you, man.
Oh, I appreciate that. All right. With those plugs out of the way, did you have anything else you needed to plug? Did you FPG or anything like that?
Nope. I'm actually getting ready to go on vacation for a few weeks. Those of you who know me really well know that I pretty much never stop working or tinkering with something, and I don't take too much time for myself, but I'm actually going on a 13-day road trip back to Wichita and Kansas City to go see mostly family and a few select friends, go fishing with my dad, spend time with my mom and stepdad, see my sister, get my holy Kansas City food trinity of Minsky's Pizza, a double high boy with cheese with onion rings and a Dr. Pepper, and of course a one big goddamn colon clogging plate of Gates barbecue.
Sounds delightful.
So, oh God, you know, it's the one thing about the Midwest that I really unabashedly miss that I can't enjoy here. I mean, here I can take in Royals baseball when I want to. I can keep track of anything else going on in the state. That's all well and good, but man, there's the best, most highly regarded barbecue in Arizona can't begin to hold a candle within the same zip code as authentic Kansas City barbecue. And for me, it always has to be the case. Period. No question. That has to be where I get those burnt ends from. that sausage, that pulled pork. Ah, and I have to get it with extra spicy sauce, fries. Probably down it with a Boulevard wheat. So as one of those parts of going back that I always look forward to, but otherwise I just kind of want some time to just kind of breathe for a little bit, just enjoy my life of leisure, because when I get back, I'm moving into a new apartment again.
All right.
God, I want this to be the last one for a while.
All right. Speaking of plugs, our next couple of we've got some space racy stuff going on here in the month of May. That's our next two On Trials. We've got Contact, which is, I believe, May 4th. Let me check the calendar here. May 4th, we will be putting Contact with Jodie Foster on trial. And then Sean will actually be entering into the Because He Made Me venue with your The Hunter from the Future. speaking of up all night, that's May 11th. And then we're back for another On Trial on May 25th. That's Aliens Week here on the Rattlers and Broadcasting Network. Now, Sean and I have already done Did to Death, all of the things that all the aliens. So we only have one movie left that we haven't done Did to Death, and that's Prometheus. So we're going to put Prometheus on trial. Sean will be defending,
which
I will be prosecuting. Oh, fantastic. Well, you get to see it and then defend it, baby doll. That's the On Trial for the month of May.
I see it and try to make sense of it.
And then June 8th, I'm going to plug this one real quick, and then we're going to call it a night. June 8th, there are a handful of movies that when I initially pitched this idea to Sean and we refashioned it into what has become On Trial, there were a handful of movies that I said, I want to do a podcast where I vociferously defend these movies against all logic and all hope and all and all reason. And he said, okay, that sounds fun. One of those movies is Superman Returns. Now, we could have done a TV party for Wonder Woman 77 with Linda Cotta. But no, even though it's Wonder Woman week, we're still going to do a Superman movie. It's the one movie we didn't do when we did The Long Road to Ruin for the Superman quadrilogy, because I said it didn't count. It was this soft reboot / sequel shit that happened there with Brandon Root, currently the Atom on Legends of Tomorrow. So we're going to go ahead and put Superman Returns on trial the week that we're also going to be reviewing Wonder Woman. And oh, a gay time will be had, ladies and gentlemen. A gay time will be had. So with that said, Sean, you want to give your final goodbyes here?
I do indeed. As I always say, and as I hope I never forget to say, thank you to everybody who listens live, who downloads, everybody who loves it and tells a friend, everybody who hates the show and tells an enemy. Thank you. You are, as always, the reason why we take time out of our busy, 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 busy schedules to nerd out with all of you and do what we do. We hope that we're always doing this better and finding new ways to make you all happy. If you have suggestions, by all means, feel more than free to let us know. We can't guarantee we'll always say yes, but we always love to hear feedback. We've made a lot of great friends this way. Thank you, as always, to Jesse Starcher for putting together the outstanding voiceover of the Night Court theme that leads us into On Trial every couple of weeks. Thank you to Alexis for originally introducing me to this week's movie way back when we were dating. And as always, never forget to never know your colors for someone else's canvas.
Ladies and gentlemen, all rise. The Honorable Judge Fudge has left the courtroom. Be well, be safe, and behave. And as Robert Winfrey once said, we don't do it for love, we do it for the money.